for Thursday, the 22nd of June, 2006. This is Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Republicans on Capitol Hill attempt to alter voting procedures in federal elections. Military families speak out, holds vigil outside Congress, urging lawmakers to take troop withdrawal seriously. And as four states deploy National Guard to the U.S.-Mexico border, we'll take a look at the treatment of migrants. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. In an address to the nation today, East Timor's president, Xanana Gusmão, threatened to resign if the country's prime minister does not leave office. President Gusmão requested the prime minister's resignation in a letter yesterday. Prime Minister Mari Alkatiri was expected to resign today, but decided otherwise after an emergency session with members of his political party. Many Timorese fought the prime minister's dismissal of 600 soldiers for triggering a series of violent protests that eventually led to the deaths of at least 24 people in the capital city and caused tens of thousands to flee their homes in fear. President Gusmão, who remains popular in East Timor despite the ongoing crisis, said he will send his resignation letter to Congress tomorrow if Prime Minister Alkatiri does not step down. An Israeli warplane fired two missiles Thursday night into the southern Gaza Strip, killing two civilians and injuring 13 others. This just hours after the Palestinian and Israeli leaders held a short, unofficial meeting in Jordan. Manar Jibrin reports.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met for an informal discussion in the Jordanian city of Petra today during a breakfast hosted by Jordan's King Abdullah. It was the first time the two sides have met since Olmert took office. The two leaders were careful to downplay the formality of today's event, but agreed to hold an official meeting in the coming weeks. Today's breakfast meeting came just before the opening of an international conference in which Nobel laureates, businessmen and politicians from around the world will discuss Israeli-Palestinian peace, other Middle East issues and global security. This as Israeli airstrikes continue against residential areas in the Gaza Strip for the second day. For Afasaran from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Peru's president-elect Alan Garcia arrived in Santiago today to meet with Chile's president Michelle Bachelet. But before he set foot in the country, exiled Peruvian groups in Chile, with the help of local lawyers, filed charges of genocide and human rights abuses against the Peruvian president-elect. From Santiago, Jorge Garretón has the story.
Before entering the presidential palace this morning to meet with President Michelle Bachelet, Peru's president-elect, Alan Garcia, was accosted by a heckler who accused him of genocide and of corruption during his first term in the mid-1980s. And at a Santiago courthouse, lawyers representing exiled Peruvian groups in Chile filed genocide charges against Garcia. The lawyers argue that Garcia is responsible for the execution, disappearance and torture of thousands of people from 1985 to 1990. Garcia fled Peru at the end of his first term, thereby escaping charges of corruption and theft of public resources, returning only after the statute of limitations had expired. Garcia is here to improve relations with Chile, damaged in the past 12 months by Lima's attempts to redraw the common sea border and by political scapegoating of Chile by the candidates in Peru's recent presidential election. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
A report released today by the National Academy of Sciences concludes that the global mean surface temperature was higher in the past few decades than in any other comparable period in the last four centuries. Scientists who researched the report say they have a high level of confidence in their findings, supported by evidence from proxies including retreating glaciers, ice cores, corals, tree rings, and ocean sediments. The government of India has imposed a ban on a drug used on livestock that has been linked to the virtual decimation of the vulture population in South Asia. Gloria Khamka reports.
While harmless to cattle, the drug diclofenac causes kidney and liver failure in vultures that feed on their carcasses. India's Director General of Health Services recently decided to ban the drug after consultations with the Ministry of Agriculture. The Drug Controller General of India, Ashwini Kumar, has issued a directive to drug controllers in all Indian states seeking a withdrawal of the drug from local markets. Kumar has also asked for a ban on the sale and manufacture of diclofenac to take effect within 3 months. The move has pleased conservationists who have been advocating a ban on the drug since 2004. Environmentalists say that ending the use of diclofenac is the best way to save the rare Indian vulture species, which plays a crucial role in the regional ecosystem. In recent years, the Indian vulture population has already plummeted by 97%. In Pune, India, I'm Gloria Khamkar for FSRN.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The House GOP is attempting to alter voting procedures in federal elections. Lawmakers are pushing for greater voting requirements for all people to ensure undocumented immigrants don't vote in federal elections. The move comes as the GOP pulled the 1965 Voting Rights Act reauthorization from the floor at the last minute. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The Federal Election Integrity Act would mandate that people show proof of citizenship when they register to vote and a picture ID to prove their identity at the voting booth. Proponents cite voter fraud and the inability to prove a voter's citizenship for the needed requirements. Republican Representative Henry Hyde from Illinois authored the legislation. He says that a large number of the millions of undocumented immigrants could be voting in U.S. elections.
It is a real problem, and the law is that a citizen should vote. Most everybody has a driver's license.
The extent of voter fraud is unclear. Some say there is widespread fraud, while others cite a small fraction. Representative Hyde testified before the House Administration Committee about his legislation. It's illegal for non-citizens to vote in U.S. elections. One could receive a felony conviction and up to 5 years in jail if caught doing so. Campaigns exist around the country to push for non-citizens to gain the right to vote if they lived in the region for 6 months. But only opponents of the immigrant vote addressed that issue. Proponents raised concerns about the impact these regulations would have on millions of citizens. Democratic Representative Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas.
This is not just an attempt to, if you will, stigmatize undocumented immigrants or if you will, make them scapegoats. You are hurting citizens of the United States, and you're hurting individuals who have different backgrounds who you would stigmatize or suggest that they are not a citizen. We need to enhance rights. We don't need to take away rights.
The concern is over people's lack of access to identification. Democratic Representative James Langevin from Rhode Island.
It could be a lance corporal in Tikrit whose parents failed to include a birth certificate in her duffel bag. It could be the Mississippi sharecropper born in his family home in a county that had no interest in recording his birth. It could be a fisherman in St. Bernard Parish, unable to find a public record of his life in the wake of Katrina's destruction. And it could be a naturalized citizen who, because of a government clerk's error, cannot obtain a copy of his naturalization papers. And maybe it's an elderly Rhode Island resident who leaves her home of 50 years to enter an assisted living facility.
It makes sense to prevent 1,000 legitimate travelers from flying who don't have ID if we can stop one terrorist who will blow up the plane, right? But it doesn't make sense with voting to exclude 1,000 legitimate voters just to stop one possible fraudulent voter.
That was Spencer Overton, professor at George Washington University Law School. But proponents of the requirements urge their necessity. Dan Stein is president of Federation for American Immigration Reform.
To do nothing is to risk jeopardizing the integrity of our electoral system, which is at the heart of our whole republic.
This hearing comes one day after House GOP leadership pulled the reauthorization of the 1965 Voting Rights Act from the floor, just hours before a debate was to begin. A number of Republicans protested the measure because of provisions that allow bilingual access at voting booths. It is unclear when the measure would be brought up again, which jeopardizes the quick passage of the bill, in which certain provisions will expire in September of next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Senate rejected two amendments today to the defense appropriations bill proposed by the Democrats. The Levin Amendment, defeated 39-60, proposed that the U.S. should pull out of Iraq by the end of this year. The second, less popular Kerry Amendment, required withdrawal from Iraq as soon as possible. In the meantime, Military Family Speak Out has been holding a vigil outside Congress to force lawmakers to make their demands to withdraw from Iraq more serious. Anastasia Gonestitska reports from Washington, D.C.
Today's long-awaited vote on the redeployment of troops from Iraq was again voted down by the United States Senate. Senator Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island was the only Republican to support the Levin Amendment.
To send the word to the insurgents, we're not going to be there permanently, but gives enough flexibility to the administration. It's not shall, the language is should.
Republican Senator McCain from Arizona voted against both the Levin and Kerry amendments. He stated, nevertheless, that the entire country, including the Republicans, is looking forward to end the war in Iraq.
I think most Americans want us to leave, but they're not prepared to have an arbitrary date or condition for withdrawal. Generally in tune with most Americans who are very frustrated, but feel that a premature termination of U.S. troops would be harmful. And of course, the Democrats always give us a little bit of a break by having two competing proposals of their own. God bless them.
The fact that Democrats proposed two distinct amendments raised concerns that Senate Democrats are split on the topic. Senator Barack Obama from Illinois disagrees.
Despite the enormous misgivings that privately are expressed by Republicans with respect to the war, for example, the president can call in all the Republicans, give them a book, a manual on how to respond to these issues. It's much more difficult for Democrats to do that. This whole notion that the Democrats are hugely divided on Iraq is completely overstated. I mean, if you look at the differences between the Kerry Amendment and the Levin Amendment, both amendments say we should start withdrawing troops. There are tactical differences.
Still, a number of Democrats voted against the amendments to pull out of Iraq. Those Democrats included Senator Dayton from Minnesota, Senator Landry from Louisiana, Senator Lieberman from Connecticut, Senators Nelson from Florida, Nelson from Nevada, and Pryor from Arkansas. Stacey Bannerman from the organization Military Families Speak Out says that those who vote against troop redeployment are out of touch with reality concerning this war.
These folks in Congress, with the exception of maybe a handful of them, none of the rest of them even have loved ones in the military, much less who have served in Iraq. So they're so completely out of touch with the horror of this war. They're not listening to the majority of Americans. That is not democracy.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditskaya in Washington, D.C.
Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao is on an African tour, which will include a visit to five countries on the continent, including a trip to Uganda this week. The visit comes at a time of growing speculation over China's assistance in sustaining dictatorships and armed conflicts in Africa in its quest for oil and other trade ties. Joshua Chilimpa reports.
Amnesty International released a report stating that China has supplied large quantities of small arms and light weapons to countries in the Great Lakes region of Africa over the past 15 years, where gross violations of human rights have occurred. According to the report, Uganda is among several African countries on Prime Minister Jiabao's tour that have arms deals with China. Uganda Army spokesman Major Felix Kulaije says there is nothing wrong with Uganda acquiring arms from China.
It's indeed speculative, unscientific, and absurd for Amnesty International to allege.
It's indeed speculative, unscientific, and absurd for Amnesty International to allege that the so-called arms bought from China ended up in the wrong hands in the Democratic Republic of Congo. There is no evidence. A mere sight of an AK-47 is not enough reason to claim that those are arms from China. There have been instabilities in this region in the southern Sudan and Somalia and Burundi and DRC itself, so it's very easy for wrong elements to access arms. Amnesty did not also indicate that there is an EU member country manufacturing guns in this region. How come they have not mentioned it? So their claim is absurd, speculative, and unscientific.
In the past, Uganda has been accused of invading the DR Congo and plundering its natural resources. Possible access to the Lake Albert region could make Uganda an oil-producing nation. Professor Xu Zhangwu, a Chinese diplomat and director of political department at the Chinese embassy in Kampala, says China shares the same vision with the African countries, and it's not driven by oil interests.
I think such criticism is nonsense. The total import of oil of China from the world market is only about 6% of the oil in the world market. The United States, they imported more than 25% of the world market. And even Japan, they imported maybe around 17% of the world market. And the Chinese tire with the African countries, they had good relationship based on mutual benefit and mutual support and cooperation because we know each other. What's the aim? We want to struggle for development for ourselves. We never to criticize the other countries, what they do. So how we say who is the dictator and so on.
But Professor Funadul of Makerere University in Kampala, also a coordinator of a research organization for human rights and involvement in the Great Lakes region, says China better puts aside its business interests in Africa and urges its partners to improve the human rights.
Right now, I think China is more interested in taking over where the West used to dominate. And if you put human rights ahead of that, then you don't achieve it. Normally, money erodes human rights. It erodes identity. It erodes sovereignty. It erodes all the things that humanity values ahead of money.
Chinese diplomats in Kampala say the Prime Minister will sign agreements with countries on his visit in areas of energy, telecommunications, industry, and others, and that the main purpose of the trip is to promote ties between China and Africa. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Peace talks between Somalia's government and the Islamist movement that controls the country's capital are underway in Khartoum today. Giving into a key demand, the Union of Islamic Courts has agreed to recognize the interim government, and Sudan's president called the talks the beginning of the end of conflicts in Somalia. Meanwhile, the conflict in Sudan has caused some refugees to flee to Israel, and this influx of Muslim refugees is causing a stir in the Jewish state. There are now more than 200 Sudanese refugees who have arrived via Egypt. Many cross the Sinai Desert on foot, only to land in Israeli jails. Their plight and their incarceration in particular has provoked a spirited debate inside Israel, with many groups arguing that Jews who were victims of genocide the last century cannot turn away refugees fleeing genocide in Darfur today. The United Nations has requested that for security reasons we not use the real name of the Sudanese refugee interviewed by Iris Mackler in this report from Jerusalem.
I have so many dreams, and this kind of dreams cannot be achieved in a country like Sudan because everything will be against you. Whenever you dream, they turn your dream into nightmare, and whenever you laugh, they also turn it into a big cry.
30-year-old Ndaluvu has been on the run for 6 years, ever since the Janjaweed militia rampaged through his village in Darfur, killing many, including his father.
They come in horses. Why? Because horses are a bit faster. They do whatever, the worst ever you could imagine. They kill, they do anything they can. And nobody stops them. The government is standing by their side.
That night sparked a three-country odyssey that still isn't over and has seen this young Muslim man end up a prisoner in the Jewish state. After a year behind bars, Ndaluvu is one of the few lucky ones to be released. He now lives and works as a gardener on an isolated kibbutz. Although this is a form of house arrest, Ndaluvu's happy for the first time in years.
A little place at the heart of the desert. It's totally green. People here are working like as a group.
Do you like that?
Yes, really, you know, because you just can't work things out unless you unite.
After the attack on his village in the year 2000, Ndaluvu joined the opposition Sudanese Liberation Movement. This led to him being arrested. He escaped from the Sudanese police and fled to Egypt. Then in 2004, Egyptian police arrested him for working without the correct immigration papers. He spent 10 days in the police cells and contracted tuberculosis.
10 days, like 10 years, they destroy me totally.
With the help of a local church, Ndeluva received some treatment. But he decided on a drastic solution to the problem of being an illegal immigrant in Egypt. He'd cross the Sinai Desert and seek refuge among the Jews. He'd do this even though his passport is marked valid for every country except Israel, and Sudan and Israel are technically at war.
I don't have visa, I don't have a valid passport. I have courage. All I had is courage, I have nothing else.
And Ndeluva crossed the desert by bus and then on foot. He walked all night and smuggled himself into Israel. But he made one crucial mistake. He didn't take water. In the end, he was so thirsty that he actually gave himself up to Israeli soldiers. The soldiers patched him up, and then the state of Israel threw Ndeluva into jail.
I don't think, once again, anyone can fairly expect Israel to be the answer for this very large continental humanitarian problem.
Mark Regev is the spokesman for Israel's foreign ministry. He says that Israel won't send Ndeluva and the others back to Sudan, but it can't take all these refugees and certainly doesn't want any more.
It must remember that Israel doesn't have a common border with Sudan. They're coming here because the first point of departure is not accepting them.
On his desert kibbutz, Ndeluva works while he waits to find out his fate. He says he understands that Israel can't take every refugee, but he argues that the international community bears responsibility for the Sudan crisis and the plight of refugees.
They have to stop the people before they run, and they have to protect them before they move. Colin Powell, the Kofi Annan, all those people of concern was in that place, but nothing happened. For how long?
While the politicians talk, 200 Sudanese refugees remain in Israeli jails. The UN's trying to find a third country willing to take them in. And in Darfur, the dying and desperation continue. Iris Makler, Free Speech Radio News, Jerusalem.
California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas have begun sending National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, part of President Bush's plan to rotate as many as 6,000 soldiers on the border until new Border Patrol agents are trained by 2008. Meanwhile, in Tucson, human rights advocate coalition No More Deaths is teaming up with the University of Arizona researchers to document the treatment of migrants by Border Patrol agents, as well as other factors that impact border crossers. From Tucson, Patrick Engstrom-Poor files this report for FSRN.
The U.S. Border Patrol says an average of 880 migrants have been apprehended every day since October 1st in the Tucson sector, an area running from Yuma on the western border to the New Mexico border in the east. But estimates from other sources say anywhere from 200 to 2,000 are returned to Nogales daily. More National Guard troops arrived to southern Arizona this week, and U.S. officials continue to claim that the troops on the border will not be used for enforcement, only for so-called infrastructure and communication projects, so that the Border Patrol can detain more border crossers. But the Human Rights and Migrant Advocacy Coalition No More Deaths says that failed economic and immigration policy is the root cause of undocumented immigration, and that more enforcement will not reduce the number of people crossing the border. This week, No More Deaths, which has participated in desert search activities and a walk for migrant rights, is launching a new project with Tucson-based academics. Guadalupe Castillo of the group Derechos Humanos, which is part of the coalition, elaborates.
This project calls for interviews with migrants who are returned from the United States at Nogales and Agua Prieta. This documentation will be carried out by No More Deaths volunteers and others who will be meeting buses at these ports. We want to examine the impact of border policy and continued militarization on the fundamental human rights of migrants. In particular, we will look at how the individual was impacted by the basic needs of food, water, shelter, medical care, family unity, physical and psychological treatment.
Dr. Linda Green is an anthropologist also at the University of Arizona who has examined the immigration journey for Guatemalan and Mexican immigrants, and she is currently writing a book on border policy. In her interviews with migrants, she has also gathered testimony indicating human rights abuses.
I've talked to a number of people who talk about the deplorable conditions of no food, no water, no real sanitary facilities, perhaps just a bucket in the middle of the room. People are crowded into a small cell, 20, 25 people at a time. Now, I've been to a community meeting here in Tucson where the Border Patrol was confronted by legal residents who had been picked up and thrown into those detention centers and verified those deplorable conditions.
For FSRN, I'm Patrick Engstrom-Poor in Tucson.
Tony Blair's government has brought in a number of new laws that carry the potential to restrict demonstrations in Britain. But, as FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports from London, an old law is being used by British police at an unprecedented rate, which targets the placards used by protesters.
Section 5 of the Public Order Act makes it an offence to use threatening, insulting or abusive words or behaviour or disorderly conduct, or to display any writing, sign or other visible representation which is threatening, abusive or insulting. Protesters are now finding themselves in legal hot water by publicly displaying that which has moved them to demonstrate in the first place.
We certainly don't do anything threatening when we're on a protest, and that would be completely contradictory to our aims, which is to raise awareness and to get public opinion on our side.
Joe Moody is part of a group demonstrating outside Vodafone shops against their funding of animal experiments at Oxford University.
We just stand there, we show our posters, we hand out leaflets. People who may be customers of Vodafone, they have the right to know what the company they're buying from is up to.
These demonstrators display posters depicting legal animal rights experimentation in the UK. Demonstrator Keith Richardson.
There have been 16 arrests so far for these demonstrations. I've been arrested 4 times. For a breach of Section 5 of the Public Order Act, a precondition is that your behaviour or pictures that you show should be threatening, abusive or insulting. And we're clearly not doing that. We're educating the public, we're informing the public. We have an argument about that, and then we get arrested. That's what happens.
So far, nobody has been charged with any offence relating to these arrests. Once in the police station and they have to start writing their statements and gathering together the evidence, they realise they don't have enough evidence to charge us because the offence has not been committed.
Criminal defence lawyer Malcolm Fowler.
Civil libertarians like me often muse as to who is actually causing the harassment and alarm. The dignified protesters, perhaps upsetting people, making them uncomfortable by images that they want to forget about, or the police going in over the top and distressing and alarming everyone in sight. It's stretching the envelope of the original Section 5 Public Order Act procedure, and when that particular provision was going through Parliament, I don't imagine that anyone imagined for a moment that it would have to do with this sort of activity. It's a very handy, low-key tool for the state to close down activities that they find uncomfortable. That sort of uncomfortable protest is the lifeblood of any worthwhile society.
Protester Joe Moody again.
The pharmaceutical industry is very powerful in this country. Animal research is worth a lot of money to the economy. There's been a lot of successful animal rights campaigning over recent years. Multinational companies getting worried about the amount of protest activity in Britain, and they are putting pressure on the British government. The regional police forces are being instructed by the government to crack down on animal rights activity. The chiefs in the regional police forces are telling their men on the streets to arrest animal rights people.
These protesters are now seeking a judicial review, where they hope to show that police are acting unlawfully, contravening their rights to freedom of expression under the Human Rights Act. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.